Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome, everyone, to a brand new series of motorsport podcasts. Many of you will have listened to our Engineering Formula One Drivers series with the likes of Patrick Head, Adrian Newey, and Gordon Murray earlier this year. I'm delighted to bring you the next set of recordings. This time, we turn our attention to the Scuderia, the Formula One team that's so famous, it's simply referred to as the team. Founded in 1939 and a constant on the F1 grid since that first world championship in 1950, Ferrari is the team that every driver wants to race for. 221 pole positions, 253 fastest laps, 238 Grand Prix victories, and let's not forget the 16 Formula One world championships. For all its success and wonderful history, though, Ferrari has always been a tricky place to work. Many drivers have left or been unceremoniously kicked out after little more than a season. What is Ferrari like to drive for? And what of Enzo himself? In this series of podcasts, we speak to the men who know best, those lucky few who have driven for Ferrari during their Formula One careers. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Motorsport Podcast. We're joined today by Ivan Capelli for another one in our series of Driving for Ferrari. We've got masses to talk about. Obviously, you guys will know about Ivan, Formula 3 champion, both Italian and European, won the Formula 3000 championship, and then went into Formula 1, mostly driving for Leighton House and, of course, Ferrari. Ivan, thank you so much for joining us. Very kind of you to spare some time. I wanted to start by rewinding the clock to your very first Ferrari experience, because I think you went to Fiorano aged 11. It had quite a profound impact on your life.
Yeah, I had a few opportunities to go to Fiorano. The first one was actually in 1984 when I met for the first time the Commendatore, because the Italian press gave me a prize. It was called Tartaruga d'Oro, gold turtle, that is the symbol of Tazio Nuvolari, as you know. And I was a very young guy. I was driving in Formula 3, and I met the Commendatore for the first time in my life, obviously. And it was a great honor, obviously, to be part of this lunch that usually had all the Italian journalists. That was an excuse basically to stay with Ferrari and to have the possibility to chat with him and put a lot of pressure on him basically by the journalist asking not really fair questions to the Commendatore. But and it was a part of this event, and it was extremely emotional for me, obviously. And then finally in 1992 I went to the Ferrari team. I joined the team and I had my first experience in Fiorano when I tested the car for the first time, obviously, before the season.
And did you go to Fiorano when you were aged, was it 11, with your father?
Yes, basically I started my dream in Fiorano at that stage, because my father was producing the commercial for Parmalat, one of the sponsors that was sponsoring a lot of Formula One drivers like Niki Lauda, Clay Regazzoni, and Brambilla or other drivers. And I was a young boy, and I went there for the first time because I was following my father, because I was in love with the work that my father was doing, producing this commercial. And I had the opportunity to smell for the first time the perfume, because this is the real perfume of the Formula One, you know, the fuel, the tires, uh, the, the, the special perfume that we have in the paddock. And I had another very big experience because the chief mechanic of Niki Lauda, Ermanno Cuoghi, he saw me on the side when I was there, my father was looking at me, and I really understand very well when I had the possibility to get closer to the car and when it was too dangerous, obviously. And then the car was stopped because the mechanic, they were working on the car, and Ermanno Cuoghi called me and he said, come here, little chat, come here. And he put me inside the car of Niki Lauda, the 312 T2. And for the first time I had in front of me the steering wheel with the Cavallino in the middle of the steering wheel. And obviously it was just a flash. After that, I came back home and I forgot soccer. And I start to and I start to draw Formula One cars and then to dream to dream as a driver, to become a driver.
You know, Ferrari has this amazing kind of pull from around the world, and it has hugely dedicated fans. And every motorsport fan grows up with Ferrari. You know, the pinnacle of motorsport in so many ways. Is that even stronger if you're Italian?
Absolutely. It's stronger. Yeah. There is a very famous sentence that the commendatore said several times during his face to face with the journalist or with the fan, saying that if a young boy is drawing a Formula One car, this car absolutely will be red. And this is the reality. I mean, if someone is actually drawing a Formula One car, a young boy is just drawing a red car, because the Ferrari is an icon in the motorsports world.
And so I wanted to just obviously talk about your time at Ferrari, but I think we can't just jump all those years and miss out Leighton House, because you arrived in Formula One and you were still competing in Formula 3000 when you started racing in Formula One, but you were the bright young Italian star. You'd won these, Formula 3 championships, back to win the Formula 3000 championship. And then Leighton House, and everyone I've spoken to said, God, his results in that Leighton House were amazing. Mm-hmm. But actually, if you look at the results all written down, the Leighton House car let you down a lot of the times. So you had a lot of retirements. Having gone from winning these championships in the lower formula, was that a very difficult thing to kind of get your head around when you knew the talent was there, but you just could not show it in that Leighton House on most occasions?
Well, we had the best year, obviously, was the 1988, when we started with the car thrown by
Adrian Newey.
Yeah. And unfortunately, we had the opportunity in 1988 and in 1989 to have the best in all the areas, because Adrian was drawing the car, Mario Illien was producing the engine, because we had also a 10-cylinder called Leighton House in 1989 and 90. So we have all the possibility to really to become a big team. Unfortunately, after the season that was, as you said, really poor in terms of reliability in 1989, unfortunately, Adrian Newey decided to leave the team. And after that, we had some other engineers, good engineers, like Chris Murphy, but we didn't have the real, the real back of the car that could actually give me the opportunity to reach great level. We did some good races, like in Portugal or in France, but it was just one during the year, not consistently as at the top as it should be.
And it was later in the season in Japan where I think you were the first driver of a non-turbo car to lead a Grand Prix since 1983. And that goes, I suppose, goes on to sort of Adrian Newey, and you know, he was such a young designer and engineer at that stage of his career. You know, Leighton House has really, really sort of cut his teeth after IndyCar. But he was obviously, you could, I guess you could see as a driver how talented he was.
Yes, because from my point of view, Adrian is it was, and he is still the only genius that there is in Formula One at the moment.
Really?
Yeah, because he was so clever in interpreting the rules, obviously, in 1988, and you could see in that car that the car was had a flow from the front to the rear, have this this design, this concept that was extreme, because it was very, very hard for us, for example, to drive the car, for myself and Maurizio Guglielmin, because the cockpit was so tight. We had a steering wheel that was 25 centimeter of diameter. We didn't have the possibility to have the footrest in the car. I mean, it was really something difficult to survive in that cockpit. But but the performance were really extraordinary. Yes.
Yeah, because I think it was the first test or the first race that, because the cockpit was so tight, there wasn't space for your knuckles either side of the steering wheel. So Adrian basically cut out the bodywork and then overnight basically put on these bulges so that you actually had space to steer.
It was related to the gear lever, because first of all, when I test the car, I tried the mock-up in England, in UK, and the wood mock-up was fair. It was fine. I mean, I could actually see it and find my position. Then when the real car came to Italy for the first test and in Imola, I sat in the car, and then I couldn't actually grab the gear lever. It was really impossible because I was touching the cock, the monocoque. And then I asked to Adrian, what we do? And he was thinking and said, yeah, okay, you stay in the car. And then they asked a mechanic to take the gear lever. And I could hear in the back of the garage some noise, like an hammer banging on the gear lever. And then when he came back, he put the gear lever inside. The gear lever was actually bent to the front. Okay? And he said, can you then use the gear lever like this? And then I tried to find a way to change the gears. And he said, well, I can try. I mean, okay, so go out and learn how to drive the car like this. This is how Adrian was actually could find a solution for the gear lever.
many years ago, Motorsport did an article on reuniting Adrian Newey with that Leighton House and him driving it. I think it was at Silverstone.
Yes, I saw the video.
And he looked really squashed when he was, and as he put his sort of visor on, he said, "I don't know what they're all complaining about," but he was, I mean, he was squashed like
but,
that.
But we had with also another experience at the end of 1988. After the whole season, hearing us, myself and Maurizio, complaining about the car and the cockpit, we were in Vallelunga doing some private test, and then we were having a lunch between the morning and the afternoon. And during the lunch, we say to Adrian, "Adrian, the cockpit is really tight. For the next season car, you should find a way to give us a little bit more space, because." And he said, it's not so very tight. Said, look, you should try the car. You try the car? Why not? And then in the afternoon, he borrowed an overall from Maurizio, an helmet from me, and then the shoes and so on. And then he drove the car in Vallelunga, just obviously 2-3 laps, very, very slow. And then he stopped and he said, you see, I can drive the car, so you can do the same.
Amazing. He is one of a kind. Very much one of a kind. But yeah, that 88 absolutely. Car, I think, was the best car you drove, wasn't it? In terms of, because I read somewhere that was your favorite car.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
1988 was a car that gave us the opportunity really to fight against the other Formula One car with the turbo engine, with actually 70, 80, or even 100 horsepower more than us. But because of the aerodynamics, because of the reaction that the car could have, we could really fight against them, and we did some extremely, let's say, interesting races because we were so quick. I mean,
that kind of car. And then to move on to Ferrari, do you remember that phone call from Ferrari to ask you to?
Absolutely, because race. I had already a contract with Scuderia Italia. My contract was already, alive with the Scuderia that was using the 12-cylinder Ferrari engine for the season 1992. And so I went to Parma, to the Dallara team, manufacturer, to try my seat, my Formula One car and my cockpit and so on. And then I was at home and I received a phone call from Mr. Lombardi, who was the chief of the Reparto Corse of the Ferrari. And he said to me, look, Mr. Capelli, would you like to join us in the next season, 1992? And I said, look, I have already a Dallara contract. I mean, I have already a Formula One car for next year. And I signed this contract already. And he said to me, no, for the contract, there is no problem. We can manage to find a solution with the Scuderia. But would you like to come or not? He said, yeah, obviously, as an Italian, to become a Ferrari driver, I can actually walk to Maranello to test the car. I mean, and so that was the call. Basically, without knowing anything of the project of the 1992, without having talked to the engineers, I was completely blind on the solution of the or what they decided to put together for the 1992. I just signed the contract and I went to Ferrari, expecting obviously to have a car competitive like the 1991, because the 1991 Ferrari was really competitive. I tried the car in the winter using that car. In Barcelona, in Spain, and I remember very well that we broke the records of the circuit during the winter test with that car, the 641. And yeah, then when we moved to the 92, was unfortunately. What I can say.
well, we'll come to that. We'll come to that in a bit. But I mean, as an Italian, as you know, you've been in Formula One for, you know, five or so years. It must have, when you put the phone down, it must have kind of, what went through your head? Because you must have thought, I've made it. I finally made it. Because whilst Leighton House was obviously, you got great results with them, you know, Ferrari is the ultimate, isn't it?
Yeah, I can tell you a very nice story about that, because when we had the press release and the presentation of the drivers for the 1992, I drove my car from Milan to Modena, and a journalist of the Autosprint magazine, that probably you know, it was, yeah, is one still the only magazine that we have in Italy that is actually talking about motorsports. One of these journalists, Diego Forti, he came with me, basically. And we went from Milano to Modena. I was driving a car not of the Gruppo Fiat, not the brand. And I was stopping, refueling the car near Piacenza. Okay? So, at, let's say, 8 o'clock in the morning, I stopped, I refueled the car, we had a coffee, I paid without any problem. Then we joined Maranello. We had the press conference. So the two Ferrari drivers were announced for the 92 season, myself and Gianellesi. And then at the end of the day, because I didn't have any other things to do in Maranello, I came back to Milan, where I was living with my family. And the journalist came with me again. And for a play of the situation, I mean, we have to refuel again in the same, let's say, petrol station that was facing the one of the morning. And when I stopped, so basically 12 hours of difference from morning to evening, I spent there nearly, maybe half an hour, to refuel, because as soon as I start to refuel, one guy recognized me, then he said, "Ah, one photo there. And then he came, all the friends, "Oh, come here, there's the new Ferrari driver." So my life actually changed from the morning to the evening. I was not able to walk anymore, even in Milan, because it was really crazy.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's just instant. And I suppose you get the other side of it, though, don't you? Because the Italian press has always been quite harsh on Ferrari if there is a problem on this, and actually they can be very, very difficult for the drivers as well. So I suppose that, you know, your petrol station story is the wonderful side of driving for Ferrari and being Italian. Yeah. But there's the negative side, isn't there? And you suffered from that, especially before, I think it was Monte Carlo.
Yes, because it was a very strange situation. For sure, the Italian press was putting a lot of pressure on me, on the Ferrari team, everybody, because the results were not satisfying anybody, and so we really had a real problem. But in Monte Carlo, I remember very well that the press came out with a very funny story that was saying that I had a particular disease, that is the Mediterranean anemia, I think.
Yeah.
And then I realized in that moment that I didn't have nobody that could actually help me inside the Ferrari structure, because no one of the staff or even the president, let's say that took my side, and I created the opportunity to, in a sort of way, to defend my position. Okay, so I was just released in front of the press without any support from the management, the Ferrari management. And in that moment, I realized that I was completely alone in that team, and I couldn't find a way to turn over my season, because it was a clear message that something was already had been already decided in terms of my career in Ferrari.
Yeah, it's funny that, because obviously for this series we've been talking to quite a lot of Formula One Ferrari drivers, and you do get the impression that actually the kind of the support around the drivers, and I don't know if this is still true, I don't think it is, but it was very much lacking. Or was that a Formula One kind of wide problem, or was that more Ferrari that didn't support its drivers if times were tough? Because I think you had to take the blame once when there was suspension failure, and you had to take the blame for that, for the good of the team.
Yeah, we had a lot of critical situation regarding the reliability of the car, not just to finish the race, but for safety reason, let's say. And in some situations it was really, really critical. But and as you said, I took the blame for the mistake that I was doing behind the steering wheel, even if behind that it was a bigger problem regarding the car and the reliability of the car. But let's say that to stay in Ferrari, there is a mixture of situation that must create the opportunity to in some let's say that you have to survive, because you have the pressure from the press, you have the pressure from the management, the technician, and so on, the pressure from all the people around you, because this the possibility of the life to become someone that really could make the difference in the history of a legend, because Ferrari is a legend, and all this mixture is creating. If you are not strong enough, or if you are not let's say prepared to that, it's really difficult to manage it.
Yeah, and when you first tested that 92 car, how quickly did you know that you were going to have a really tough season?
Immediately, because a Formula One driver, or a a talented driver can realize immediately if the car is a good one or not. To make an example, when I did the first five laps of the Leyton House 1988, immediately I realized that the car was a good car. It's true that it was coming from the 1987, that there was a Formula 3000 modified just to participate in Formula 1. But having said that, immediately you could feel in the steering wheel that the grip was there. At the same time, when I was driving for the first time the 1992 in Portugal, I realized that what we were expecting from the double flat bottom, the front suspension and so on, it was not working and not giving the extra downforce that we were expecting. And at the first meeting with the engineers, I had one side of the team saying, this car is brilliant. With this car, we can win races or even competing for the championship. And on the other side of the table, let's say my side, I was looking at the time and was saying, look, but the Williams team with the electronic suspension is nearly 1 second, 1 second and a half quicker than us every single lap. How we can compete? We should work a lot to get this limit and to modify our car or to find the right setup. And this was actually understood like Lucet saying that the car was not good enough, or what was basically a track, like Alain Prost said the year before, no?
Yeah.
And immediately the engineers were listening more on the good side of the table instead of understanding that it was criticized the car, but not because it was saying that it was completely a disaster, but because we had to work a lot to get this car competitive.
Do you think it was the situation was almost made worse by the competitiveness of the FW14B, the 92 Williams car, which was just so, so quick? And actually, if you took that out of the equation, it would have been a lot less painful a year. I know that sounds ridiculous, but that car was so quick that I guess it probably made your situation worse.
We had a lot of car in front of us, not just the Williams. We had the Benetton. The Benetton as well, they were quicker than us with the Ford 8-cylinder. Then sometimes the McLaren, obviously, they were sometimes quicker than us. We were competing with a lot of team, a lot of drivers. More or less the situation that they have in Ferrari now, during this year, having not being just the second, but even the third or the fourth team of the grid. And this is being, also because I must say that, for example, in 1992, the car was designed to use the transversal gearbox. But inside the Ferrari team, we had just two gearbox working properly. And these two gearbox were actually... These two gearbox were actually... the supplied to Jean Alesi, who's actually recognized as a first driver. So my car, for the first seven races, we use the 91 back of the car, suspension, longitudinal gearbox with a different aerodynamic package as well. And so for the first seven races, we had two different cars inside the Ferrari team. But obviously, no one is actually remembering this situation that we had. And when I was closer to Jean, like in Imola, when we were seventh and eighth, I think, on the grid, because we had in front of us the two Williams, the two Benettons, the two McLaren, and so on. When the engineers were reading the performance, they said, Capelli is near Alesi. That means that Alesi didn't use the car properly. It should have been two or three places in front of him. So not recognizing that with different cars, I was actually matching the performance of Alesi because I was actually pushing 120% over the top of the limit.
And, you know, obviously there are lots of low points from that year, but there must have, in amongst everything that was going on, were there, are the moments you look back on with fondness? I mean, driving a Ferrari at Imola in front of Italian fans as an Italian must have been, you know, despite the car not performing as you wanted it to, it must have been a wonderful moment, surely.
All the moments that that I had with the Ferrari in that year were fantastic everywhere, because as you said at the beginning, there are 20 Ferrari. At the moment in that period, we had the 24, even more, Formula One drivers participating to the championship. But that just two are the Ferrari driver, and worldwide, everybody is actually remembering, or in that year is knowing, that one of the two is Capelli or Alesi, or basically knowing the two Ferrari drivers, the name of the two Ferrari drivers. So this is the difference inside the Formula One, why the Ferrari is so well known, and obviously so magic to compete for that team.
Yeah. Have you had to buy a drink in Italy since that 1992 season? Now, if you're looking for more Ferrari content, then you may well be interested in Motorsport's latest publication. Ferrari, From Race to Road, celebrates the journey of the world's most famous car brand and its unique place in motor racing history. Using Motorsport's unmatched archive of stories and photographs, we trace the Ferrari story from its early days under Enzo right up to date, with interviews with current F1 star Charles Leclerc and F1 team boss Mattia Binotto. Along the way, we celebrate some of the all-time classic race cars, including the wonderful 1975 312T and races such as the Targa Florio. Plus, we test some of the greatest Ferrari road cars. Illustrated with world-class photographs and wonderful writing, Ferrari From Race to Road is a must-have for all fans of the marque. It's on sale now in all good newsagents, or you can buy it via the Motorsport website, which is motorsportmagazine.com. That year, I was doing sort of research and things, and I was looking at some of the things that you said about that 1992 year, and I've got something. You basically the kind of words, so much pressure, you reached your limit, and really there was a lack of concentration. Do you think? I mean, it would have broken so many drivers. Do you think it was Ferrari that kind of broke you psychologically, do you think? And the performance of that car and all the politics in the background?
For sure, I had a different experience with the Leighton House team. I had 5 years with the Leighton House team, 4 years with the Gugelmin, my teammate, and we were sharing everything, all the information, all the critical moment, but also the enthusiasm of participating in Formula One with a little team that actually was pushing to reach good performance without any politics inside the team. I mean, if I had something and technical that I had to share with Morris, it was ready for him. I mean, it was not nothing that to hide or to be jealous of. In Ferrari, I learned immediately that even talking to people was creating some critical critical situations, because you couldn't speak a lot too much with the engineers of Jean, because then the other one was jealous because you were talking about talking to this guy. And then I learned that having the car that was not performing well, then the engineers from the engine, they were complaining about the aerodynamics, but the aerodynamics people complained about the engine. So you have to create or to be careful of what's saying, what you have to say during the meeting, the technical meeting. It was really a completely different world, and probably having my attitude, my natural attitude, it is not so political. I was not ready to fight and to be part of this kind of mentality.
Yeah. Now, for all you listening and watching, one of the great pieces actually that you did with Motorsports, that Motorsport used to do a series called The Worst Car I Drove. In the series, there's loads of different cars mentioned, and very, very few people talk about a Ferrari Formula One car. But Ivan, obviously, quite rightly, says the worst car I drove was that 92 Formula One car. But you can find that on the archive online. So do have a read, because it's a wonderful piece. Mm-hmm. And while you're on there, look at the shop, because there's loads of Ferrari memorabilia and bits and pieces on there. I've got loads of questions here, Ivan, and I usually always get told off because I get carried away chatting and mm-hmm. forget to ask readers questions. This is going sort of back to when you first started in Formula One, from the old Autosport, which I think is a Twitter account. They are asking, was it a kicker not to get a full-time drive in Formula One after your stellar drives for Tyrrell back in 85? Were there any offers on the table? I guess they're talking about 86.
But first of all, I must say that I was, and I am really grateful of what Mr. Tyrrell did for me, because he asked me to drive in Brands Hatch and in Adelaide without actually bringing any money to the team. I was just paying my expenses, travel expenses and so on. And without that opportunity, probably I could have had a more difficult time, let's say, to find the way to the Formula One. But Tyrrell gave me the opportunity really to drive and to show at the second race that I was able to finish in the points, even if the car was again very difficult to drive in comparison to the others. Then we talked with Tyrrell, but we couldn't manage to find a solution, because for 1986 he was asking a support from the sponsors, and at the time I didn't have enough money to join the Tyrrell team, basically, because as usual, you need to arrive in Formula One, or it was like that at the time, to arrive in a team and to have the opportunity, you know, to support the team a little bit with the sponsors, with the money.
Yeah. Well, it's still the same now, really, isn't it, for some of the grid?
Yeah, it's actually a little more complicated, because now they are actually buying teams to to let the son drive in Formula One. I mean, it's a little... My father couldn't actually...
No, I don't think anyone could, really. Very, very few. But someone said to me the other day, this is a few years ago, they said, do you think anyone would have believed you back in the 70s that there would be a drinks company that owned a Formula One team and it was sponsored by a car manufacturer, i.e. Red Bull and Aston Martin? I mean, it's, you know, the world is kind of upside down now.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's also true that when I arrived in Japan for the first time in 1986, when I drove for Leighton House in the Formula 2, I had to wait to arrive at the hotel to inform my mother that I was safe and I was arriving in Japan and everything was ready. Now, as you know, you are in the finger exiting for the airplane, and you're using with this.
No escape.
Yeah.
I'll just get through a few more readers' questions before we go sort of back to Ferrari. One from Ed Spencer that is an interesting question. He's asking when the first signs were that your relationship was with Ferrari was in trouble. You know, obviously we talked about you testing the car and realizing straight away that the car wasn't good. But when did you think that the relationship was in trouble?
Well, as I said already in Monaco, I had this kind of feeling when they didn't support me in this situation that the press, also because we couldn't find from where this news came out. I mean, I was absolutely fit, But for some reason, this information came out from and we couldn't find who actually gave this news to the magazines, to the Gazzetta dello Sport, that is the most important sport magazine in Italy. And then from there, also other different signals that gave me the opportunity to understand that there was already out. For example, another thing that is absolutely, let's say, unbelievable is that I met for the first time the engineer who was following my car on the airplane going to the first race in South Africa. That's something that is unreal for a Formula One team. But I met Gianfranco Fantuzzi, who was my race engineer, really on the airplane from Milan to Kyalami. And because before I was working with different engineers, Lunetta, Mr. Lunetta, then Postelwhite was there, and then they couldn't find an engineer for me. And then I met this guy, and he said, "Look, okay, where are you coming? What have you done since yesterday?" I mean, and he said to me, "Look, I'm working in the experience department of the normal road car." And he went to the track just a few times supporting the test team. And when we arrived at Kyalami, something that was a real joke is that we went to the pit wall, and Fantuzzi was looking like this, no? And I say, "Gianfranco?" He said, "Yes." "What?" "We are actually coming from that side, and we are going in that direction." So this is just to let you again understand how unreal was the situation of the 1992. Because yeah. I met the engineer in the airplane, and we started to discuss about the setup in the airplane for the first race.
Yeah. Obviously, you know, Enzo had died a few years before. Do you think that contributed to some of Ferrari's struggles then, or do you think he was he had taken a step back, you know, well before he died? Was it difficult not having that very famous figurehead?
Oh. Obviously, it was probably not, let's say, how to say. I think that Mr. Ferrari, the commendatore, was always updated about the team situation. Not being involved completely in, let's say, running the team, probably at the circuit was making in that period a big difference, because technology, the telemetry was starting to be involved in Formula One, computers and so on. Probably, I don't know how much, obviously, the commendatore was ready to understand all this. But for sure, until the last day, he was giving his input and his idea or his decision to the team. I remember very well that when I arrived in Formula One in 1987 and before 86 and 85 with Tyrrell, Michele Alboreto was already driving for Ferrari. And I remember very well, he spent 5 years, Michele, in Ferrari, in the Ferrari team. And I remember very well how much was the pressure on him and the Ferrari team from the Italian press. But also remember very well how much Ferrari was defending the position of Michele. Actually defending his work. And this could actually happen because Ferrari was there and Michele was his choice, basically.
Yeah.
And I think that after the death of the Commendatore in 1988, The mixture between the power of Fiat in Torino, Maranello in Modena with the team, the road car that in that 1992-1993, I remember very well also how many cars, normal cars, Ferrari had parked outside the factory waiting for an owner, because they couldn't sell cars, because really? The cars were not so appreciated like now, basically.
Yeah.
So also that we have to understand that also in that period we had all that problem that with the car that was really difficult to sell. So all the situation was in a critical relationship between Torino and Modena.
Yeah.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's a question here from Chris, sort of a technical one about the problems of the 92 car. He's saying Jean Alesi said that the F92A problem was actually that the 92 V12 suffered with blow-by and lacked power, and the chassis wasn't so terrible. The car was slow in a straight line in 92, but the chassis was always blamed. Can you confirm that the 92 engine was weak, as I've long suspected? That's from Chris.
Well, the engine was not for sure a strong part of the car. It's true that during the year we had to decrease the limit of the revs to get the engine a little bit more reliable. I remember very well also that in Mexico, for example, I did Friday and Saturday nearly 12 or 14 laps, because every time that I was going out, I had a problem with the engine that blew up, basically. And that was a particular moment of the season. But it's also true that, for example, the front suspension with the monoshock couldn't give us any support, because we had to really lock the front roll bar that was actually designed with the Belleville system. It was a solid front, and the car was jumping on the circuit. Jean could actually probably drive the car because he was pointing the car a lot with the front and producing a lot of grip using the front wing like
snowplow.
Yeah. And for my driving style that was impossible. And probably he could manage to do some good results because of that. But the car was for the front suspension, as we said, the engine, I was using the longitudinal gearbox. We also tried in Silverstone during the FOCA test. Postelwath designed a side ports that could close the basically the double flat bottom to have just a normal side ports without the double flat bottom, and to understand if this could actually create the opportunity to have a quicker car on the straight line. It was just the same. So,
yeah. Right, I'll take one more reader question, and then I wanted to talk about Ferrari now, just before we wrap up. This one's from Adrian King. I think it's probably going to be quite a quick answer. Please, can you ask Ivan how he came to join the team? Was his position secured before or after Prost had been dismissed?
After Prost.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, okay, yeah. Well, Adrian, I think is the most succinct and accurate answer you will get. Just before we finish, Ivan, I wanted to talk about Ferrari now, because, you know, in some ways there are mirrors. You know, yes, there's Ferrari are getting better results this year than they did in 92, but it's funny, isn't it? Ferrari has these years and these periods where, despite the incredible success the team has had, you know, whether that's Michael Schumacher, Jody Scheckter, Kimi Räikkönen in 2007, fighting for almost every world championship, you know, in the 2000s. And then they have a season like 2020. What's happened there? Why does this happen?
Well, let's say that we have to analyze the situation in two, three years ago, when President Marchionne decided to give the opportunity to the internal engineers to actually to make a step forward and to become the first line of engineers that could actually design the new cars. And I think that they did a good job. I mean, until last year, the car was really competitive. Then we have a mixture of a cross of things that actually must be underlined. For sure, the fact that FIA found a direct, let's say, agreement with Ferrari regarding the engine of 2019 is showing that last year probably they were doing something at the limit or over the limit, because it's impossible that in 1 year the engine can lose all this power. And this is actually showed also by the other teams that are using the Ferrari engine, like us and Alfa Romeo. They are behind, while last year, as you know, as you remember, they were competing with the other teams, or even, let's say, closer to the front. So that's one point. And the second one is that probably the engineers that used to draw the car in 2018 and 2019, they have lost the clue of the design, and they don't have any more solutions to the fact that the car is wrong. I remember very well in the 80s when in England, the English team, they were competing, and they had an overall, let's say, good situation in comparison to Ferrari, Ligier, or other teams that actually, Minardi, that were staying, let's say, in this country. Because in England, a lot of mechanics, a lot of engineers were changing teams during the season and bring up the quality, the know-how, sharing the know-how of the technology with a lot of teams, between teams. Ferrari, this year, in these 2 years, they closed completely their team to the external influence. And probably they need today someone that is coming from a big team, giving them the opportunity to open their mind and to find new ideas, a new way to understand and to analyze the problem that they have, in order to find the solution or to create the new project of 2022. I think that they lost the opportunity to have this contribution for the other teams. And this created the situation that they have now. The car is always the same. I remember very well 2 years ago when I was commentating for the Formula One, for the Rai, the Formula One, sorry, for the Italian television. I remember very well that the comparison between Mercedes and Ferrari. Mercedes, they were arriving at the circuit on Friday, and the setup was nearly there. They had to change just a few things. And Ferrari, sometimes, even 2 years ago, they were completely lost. I remember that they were 1 second and a half, or even more, lost from the Mercedes performance. And then they were working hard and hard during the night and the morning with the simulator in Modena. And then for some reason, on Saturday afternoon, they were competing. They're very, very close to the Mercedes. But they were always running behind, not like, as you said, in the Schumacher era or in even in other situations where the Ferrari was leading the technical situation and other teams, they were following Ferrari because they were performing absolutely well. I mean, they need now someone like, for example, I know that is impossible, but like Adrian Newey, that is coming to Ferrari and say, look, okay, you have done Formula One until now, until today in this way. Yeah. On tomorrow, we have to do this way. And yeah. Change.
So it's interesting you mentioned about Ferrari bringing up their younger engineers and promoting from within. And it's something that Derek Bell pointed out. And I know that he's obviously been out of the sport for, you know, or Formula One, you know, obviously for a lot longer. But he said, you know, in some ways, Ferrari is too Italian. And actually, you know, if you look back at their most successful era with, you know, Schumacher, there was Jean Todt. There was Schumacher, a German, Jean Todt, a Frenchman, and Ross Brawn, an Englishman. I don't think it matters where they're from.
Rory Byrne. Don't forget, yeah, Rory Byrne, yeah, that was the chief designer of the car. I mean, again, you said an example, a perfect example, that how they start to change the team is with new people, and they needed 5 years. To reach, let's say, a situation where they were the leader of the paddock and the pit, yeah, lane.
Yeah. Well, the great thing about Ferrari, though, is it's always number one in most motorsport fans' hearts, isn't it? It is the team, whether they're kind of winning or losing. The Ferrari will always be Ferrari.
Another example of my of my experience. I've spent just 1 year, as you know, with the Ferrari team, but this gave me the opportunity to work for 20 years for the Italian television to commentate the Formula One, because I was in that period a Ferrari driver. Today, or when you become a Ferrari driver, you are a Ferrari driver for the life. And even today is extraordinary. That I'm going maybe to a restaurant in Milan or even around the world. And when there is a motorsport fan, they are coming to me and they remember, even if I had just 1 year with poor performance, but they remember that I was a Ferrari driver.
Yeah. Well, Ivan, what a wonderful note to end on. I cannot thank you enough for sparing so much time. It's been great talking to you. And thank you to all of you who are watching and listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, and we'll be back again soon. Thank you very much.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.